This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay with us as we take a look at the week in WMRA and statewide news. It's been a fun weekend at the Red Wing Roots Music Festival, but we've also got a preview of another music festival that you may not have heard about coming up later this week in Luray. We'll also hear from the president of the Virginia Education Association, reforms to asset forfeiture laws, some surprising data about the demographics of Virginia's communities, and this week's episode of Our Island Universe. So I hope you can stay with us. But first, in June, a Charlottesville organization to mentor young men of color beat out more than 100 other groups across the country to snag the 100 Black Men of America's Chapter of the Year Award for mentoring. WMRA's Jordy Yeager talked with some of the young men who have excelled in the program and their mentors.
Belonging to the 100 Black Men of Central Virginia is no cakewalk. It's the largest African-American mentoring program in the area for more than 200 middle and high school students. And the kids fall under some pretty tight scrutiny.
We track things such as their daily attendance in school, their discipline referrals, their grades.
Dr. Bernard Harrison is the president of the Charlottesville-based group, which began 7 years ago. Adult mentors in the organization take the young mentees under their wings. They push them to excel in and out of school and expose them to new opportunities. And Harrison says something interesting has happened along the way.
And most recently, I was impressed to see how many of our young men who have gone through our mentoring program, and they have emerged as student leaders.
Presidents and vice presidents of their class, English Honor Society, National Mentee of the Year. Harrison says everywhere he looked, the group's young men were striving towards this year's theme of leadership impact.
Leadership is an attitude. And as long as our young men see individuals with the attitude and the belief that they are in need of being a leader, they will step up.
On a recent Monday evening at Burley Middle School, where Harrison served as principal for nearly a decade, he brought together five of these student leaders to share their experiences with the up-and-coming generation.
And so the whole idea of having this program is what they see is what they'll be. When they see young men who are leaders in their schools, the younger ones will aspire, set realistic goals, and we're going to see it emerge. We're going to see this thing grow. Our mission is about eliminating achievement gaps. And when we present positive images of our young men, we're just going to see this growth mindset change this whole community just from growing up and growing out.
The five students sat as panelists behind a long table in the school's cafeteria and addressed the audience of more than 50 younger kids and their parents.
All right, so my name is Andrew Martin. I'm in the eighth grade at Southern Middle School, and I'm also the president of the school. So, I'm the president of the school. And then...
Martin's mentor is Wes Bellamy, the only African-American member of Charlottesville City Council and the city's vice mayor. Bellamy's also a high school teacher and a member of the Virginia Board of Education. He's characteristic of many of the mentors, who hold leadership roles themselves, setting examples for the kids.
A lot of people helped me out. If they didn't help me out, I wouldn't be at the point I am today. So they've had a really big impact in my life. And the way I describe a leader is a person who doesn't, like, when there's bad times, he rises to the occasion. He doesn't fall to the occasion. Exact quotes from Wes Bellamy.
Mentors don't take the place of parents necessarily, but rather they add to the family experience, working together to connect them with a broader community outside the home. Parents in the audience ask the panel of students a wide range of questions, from what advice they would offer younger kids to how they would respond to negative feedback as leaders. Nyjee Jones has been in the 100 Black Men since he was in sixth grade. In the fall, he's headed to George Mason University. Jones recently went to the prestigious Governor's School for Fine Arts program, and he tells the crowd that he's been the only African-American lead all 4 years in theater productions at Monticello High School.
I guess you say I started that movement of, like, starting the diversity in the theater department at Monticello, so I'm pretty proud of that. So no other questions?
Yeah, let me ask you, you said you're the first African-American to be on that drama club.
Right.
If you didn't see anyone there looking like you, what prompted you to want to be a part of it?
There are a lot of girls in theater.
But in all seriousness, Jones tells the younger kids in the audience to follow their passions, pursue activities that truly interest them, even if their friends aren't doing them. Afterwards, I wanted to see what impact their advice had on younger members of the crowd. And so with Dr. Harrison by his side, I caught up with 12-year-old T.J. Brooks. He's been in the 100 Black Men of Central Virginia for about 4 years and is entering 8th grade at Henley Middle School this fall.
And what did you think of tonight?
Well, it showed a lot of us that, like, we're not the only ones striving to be, like, we can stand out as a person, but that we all could be leaders. Like, we all could show other people how leaders act. My personal belief of leadership is, like, having someone to look up to, like a role model, or having someone that you could strive to be when you get older.
And do you have a role model that you look up to?
Dr. Harrison.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
We are well into music festival season this summer, and the big Red Wing Roots Festival is getting ready to wrap up this evening. But there's another festival you may not have heard about. It's DOA Fest near Luray. WMRA's Christopher Clymer Kurtz has the story.
DOA Fest organizer Josh Turner has always felt that his family's 300 acres along the Shenandoah River is just too good not to share.
The fishing is great, the swimming is great. I mean, just being on the river is terrific, and then you got the mountains.
Turner, who lives and works as an accountant in Northern Virginia and is a big music festival fan, threw the first DOA Fest 4 years ago and hopes this year for 750 attendees. The main stage faces Kennedy Peak from a hayfield. A riverside stage overlooks midday swimmers, and the family's only campground sits on the opposite side of the property from the late-night stage, which after 1 o'clock in the morning turns into a silent disco with two DJs. The lineup this fourth year includes, among many others, Virginia bands Hemingway, Annie Stokes, like you see me now, and the Traveling Hillbillies. Two weeks after DOA Fest, Turner and his co-organizers, an uncle and a college friend, will host another festival for a second year. It's called Shensara and focuses on yoga, meditation, and centered wellness.
You get to come out here and party and have a great time, and then 2 weeks later, you know, you get to zen out and do some meditation and get back to being centered. And
for WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer Kurtz.
DOA Fest runs Friday through next Monday. Police agencies in Virginia are mostly funded by local governments, but in recent years they've been increasingly tapping another source of cash, seizing it directly from people they suspect of wrongdoing. The program known as civil asset forfeiture has become increasingly controversial in recent years, and now efforts are moving forward at the state and national level to reform the program. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
Back in November 2011, a Virginia State Police trooper pulled over a car on Interstate 95 near Emporia. The trooper said the car was speeding, and after realizing that the two men in the car were from El Salvador, he decided to search the car. That's when he found $27,000 in cash.
He didn't think that these two Hispanic guys from Salvador ought to have so much money in their car, and he thought it's a good forfeiture case.
That's David Smith, who later became a lawyer for the passenger in the car, Victor Guzman. Smith says it was not a good forfeiture case at all because these men were carrying money from their church to Atlanta, where it was going to be used to buy property for the church back in El Salvador. The trooper didn't believe it.
He also had some documents from the church, which he tried to show the trooper. And basically, this was a very arrogant trooper. He didn't really want to hear what their explanation was. As soon as he saw the money, he had decided he was going to seize it.
Seizing cash and property has become increasingly profitable for local governments, which get to keep the money they don't have to return. In Guzman's case, the money eventually was returned to the church, but only after he retained an attorney and fought it for months in court.
I have never understood how these civil asset forfeitures have stood up.
That's Virginia legal expert Rich Kelsey.
It's a troubling phenomena, and my guess is the more public attention it gets, the more sense of outrage you're going to find.
Over the last decade, law enforcement officials in Virginia have seized more than $200 million in cash and assets. Some of that money goes directly into the budget of the local police or prosecutor's office. Some of it goes to the federal government, which shares part of it with local governments. Some of it is returned because it should have never been taken in the first place.
If I were a prosecutor's office, I certainly understand why you would want the ability to seize those dollars without anyone having a right to say otherwise on the spot.
Lynchburg Commonwealth's attorney Mike Doucette says money that's seized through the state program must be approved by a judge.
And if we can convince a judge that there's a clear and convincing nexus between the asset to be forfeited and drug distribution activity, then and only then does the judge sign it. We don't seize anything without judicial approval.
But critics say law enforcement officials should be required to secure a conviction before they get to keep anything they've seized. Democratic State Senator Chad Peterson of Fairfax City offered a bill that would have done just that earlier this year.
It's not right to take somebody's property when they have been acquitted of the underlying crime.
That effort failed on a 24-16 vote. All the Republicans voted against it, and three Democrats from Northern Virginia joined in the opposition. Republican Senator Bill Carrico of Galax says Peterson's bill would have been too expensive.
If a large amount of money is seized, then who's going to account for the interest that has to be obtained if that money is given back?
Instead of requiring a conviction, Carrico introduced a successful bill that changes the burden of proof. The burden of proof will be clear and convincing evidence rather than just a preponderance of the evidence. A similar bill is now moving forward in Congress, where Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott of Newport News is a co-sponsor.
Some of these confiscations take place without even any, not only no conviction, no charge. It's take your property. And that's just not right.
The bill in Congress has already passed the Judiciary Committee with bipartisan support, and Scott says he's hopeful it'll make it to the president's desk before the end of the term. I'm Michael Pope.
Virginia may be one of the oldest states, and its history may stretch back into the past more than other states, but new numbers from the federal government are revealing a surprising twist about Virginia, and Michael Pope has that story.
It may be the Old Dominion, but Virginia has some of the youngest jurisdictions in the country. According to new numbers from the Census Bureau, Lexington has the youngest population in America, with a median age of 22.4. Lexington City Manager Noah Simon says that's probably because the city is home to Virginia Military Institute and Washington and Lee University.
Our biggest challenges are not so much the age of the population, but we have other significant challenges, such as that 64% of the properties in the city of Lexington are tax exempt.
Those properties would be the academic institutions, which don't pay property taxes.
So you could say that there's an indirect relationship between our young population and some of our revenue-type needs.
Lexington isn't the only Virginia city making the list. Radford has the fourth youngest population in America, with a median age of 23.8. Radford Vice Mayor Keith Marshall says part of the explanation for that is Radford University, but he says recent events have also contributed.
We had a Radford foundry, been known by several names, but it was a longtime foundry in the city of Radford for 100 years maybe, and it closed down in recent years, and we lost a lot of those good middle-class jobs, blue-collar jobs.
And those aren't the only jobs that have recently left Radford.
We also saw our hospital, Radford Hospital, moved out of town into Montgomery County, and we lost some of those jobs also. So there's kind of been a drain on job growth in the city of Radford.
Professor John Accordino at Virginia Commonwealth University says local governments in college towns have a sort of double whammy. Lots of young people without jobs and valuable land that can't be taxed. But there are also benefits.
It depends very much on how that institution chooses to engage with the community as to whether or not it's a net plus or a negative.
That engagement could come in ways that are difficult to quantify.
Do they provide social services? Do they care for the poor? Do they provide planning studies?
Luke Judea at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service says Virginia isn't just for lovers. It's also for young people seeking jobs and education.
Virginia is a slightly younger state than most other states. We tend to have a heavy influx of people to colleges and to military bases, and also just because we're an economically successful state.
But the Commonwealth isn't just young people. Go outside the college towns and you'll find areas where the median age is above the national average.
Virginia has several quite old counties. I mean, Highland and Bath are definitely big retirement areas. The whole area from Orange County, Rappahannock, down to the Middle Peninsula and the Northern Neck.
Frank Shafroth at George Mason University says those older people are about to create a major demographic shift because people are living longer than they ever have. He says areas with young populations like Lexington and Radford may be at the tip of the iceberg.
Not only do you have a lot of young people in this community,
But that could also reflect that many of the county's older residents now reside, but not in a home, but rather in the cemetery.
And that's a trend, he says, is only likely to grow in the coming years.
We have one of the largest generations of old people in American history who have lived longer than previous generations. So that means we're also probably at some sort of a vortex where people will be dying.
Other places with exceptionally young populations include Madison County, Iowa, Kuselvack, Arkansas, and Chattahoochee County, Georgia. I'm Michael Pope.
More than 8,000 teachers and administrators gathered last week in Washington, D.C. for the National Education Association's annual conference. Among them is Meg Gruber, president of the Virginia Education Association. Before she headed up to D.C., Gruber sat down with Virginia Public Radio's Mallory Nopain to talk about how education, at its heart, is really a local issue, not a national one.
It's very interesting when you have this national gathering to see some of the ideas in the debate, and you think about what they're saying and you realize the real problem here is their state legislature, because it's not focusing on a federal issue or something that the federal government directly controls.
So you're saying it all comes back to your state legislature, so I'm sure you get introspective of your state legislature.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We have a lot of good people in our state legislature, but some of them haven't been in a classroom since they were in the classroom themselves. When we as teachers, and not just me, but when our members and other teachers come and talk to them, either in Richmond or at home, we're the ones that are doing the job every day.
What would help provide a greater connection between the realities of schools in Virginia today and state lawmakers? What would bring those two realities closer together?
You know, one of the things that we like to try to encourage, and our members encourage, just not with state lawmakers, but local lawmakers, we really want them to come in to the classrooms and not come in because you're going to talk to, in a high school setting, you're going to talk to the AP government class. Come in for a day or two and just sit back and watch. Become wallpaper.
What would be the difference in lawmaking that would come with that knowledge?
I think in a lot of cases, what I would hope is they would look at the whole attraction and retention of teacher piece and realize, oh yeah, not everybody can do this job. And if we want quality people in our classrooms, and we want some of them to become quality administrators and, you know, all the other support positions, we've got to first of all start listening to them and treating them with respect. The most important thing in the classroom to help our students succeed is a highly qualified professional teacher. We are finding, talking to our colleagues at higher ed, that if you look at the number of people who are going to college to become a teacher, is drastically reduced.
So I hear you saying that it's going to be increasingly more competitive to attract teachers.
Oh, absolutely. When you have, for example, a system like Fairfax County, who starts the school year with a couple hundred positions still available, when you don't have those teachers to put in the classroom and you're putting in someone who's very well-meaning but is not a teacher, our students aren't getting the quality education that they need.
So how is Virginia faring relative to other states when it comes for competing for that increasingly small pool of candidates?
Well, I think one of the things that we just need to look at, not only for young teachers but to keep the teachers we have, and that is definitely to get our salaries up.
Besides pay, besides money, mm-hmm. What is important to attracting and retaining talented teachers?
Besides the money issue, which is obviously what everyone, you know, wants to talk about, it really ties into student learning conditions, which are obviously our working conditions. It really hurts when you know how hard you're working and you know what your kids need and you know that you're taking money out of your own pocket to buy supplies. And in some cases, we have members, you know, who are feeding students in their classrooms. in high poverty areas. I know of a couple elementary schools, and one has such a high poor and homeless population that they have washers and dryers in their schools so they can wash and dry the clothes for their students and provide them food. And in a lot of cases, we're not talking urban, but we're talking about rural Virginia with deep poverty issues. And it's just like they want to just seem to write a law that one size fits all. And it's like, you don't understand what our kids come to school with.
I'm Mallory Nopain.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. Two Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab staff members, William Geyer and George Wiffenbach, were in a spirited discussion over lunch on Monday, October 7, 1957. That Friday, the USSR was successful in launching the first human-made object to orbit the Earth. The conversation Monday at lunch was whether the two scientists could hear the beep, beep signal that Sputnik was broadcasting. By that afternoon, they had a lock on Sputnik. As they began listening to the first human-made sounds being broadcast from space, they realized that by using the Doppler effect and data related to it, they could figure out both the speed and the orbit of the spacecraft. The lab's deputy director called the two men into his office. He asked, if you could use the known location of a receiver on the ground to calculate the location of a satellite, can you reverse the problem? That is, could you calculate the location of a receiver on the ground if you knew the exact orbit of the satellite? The two men thought through the logic of the problem and said, yes, of course you can. And in that moment, GPS, or our global positioning system, was born. The space race was more than just a political contest of world supremacy. It ushered in a technological revolution in our journey to the stars. I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at that website, too. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning.